Chapter 2. Jacob and Esau. Lunar Syntax. In the fine language which we have heard, the evening antiphony between Jacob and his volatile favorite at the well, the old man had mentioned Eliezer, who was born to their forefather by a slave woman during the family's sojourn at Damascus. Nothing is clearer than that Jacob's words could not have referred to the learned old man of that name. Himself, the manumitted son of a slave woman, and probably Jacob's own half-brother, who lived in Jacob's camp, with two sons named Damasek and Elinos, and used to instruct Joseph in much useful and much superfluous knowledge under the tree of wisdom. It is clear as daylight that the man Jacob meant was the Eliezer whose firstborn son, Abram, the wanderer from Ur, or Haran, had long been obliged to regard as his heir, until first Ishmael, and then, fantastically enough, though it had ceased to be with Sarah after the manner of women, and Abram himself was so old that you might say he had lived 100 years, Yitzchak, or Isaac, the true son, saw the light of day. But daylight is one thing, and moonlight another. And it was moonlight that had presided over the bestowing of all that superfluous knowledge. Things looked differently under the moon and under the sun. And it might be the clearness of the moon which would appeal to the spirit as the truer clarity. Therefore, let us agree and admit among ourselves that when Jacob spoke of Eliezer, he did mean his own steward and first servant. Him, too, that is. Both at once. And not only both, but the Eliezer altogether. For since the time of the oldest Eliezer, Eliezer the freedman had often been in existence in the camp of the head of the tribe, and often had sons named Damasek and Elinos. And Jacob might be certain that his view of this matter would also be the view of Joseph, who was far enough from distinguishing clearly between his old mentor and the original Eliezer, and had the less reason to do so, in that the old man himself did not, who, in referring to himself, as often as not had in mind Eliezer the servant of Abraham. For instance, he had more than once told Joseph the tale of how he, among the kin of the family in Mesopotamia, had wooed Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel and Laban's sister, for Isaac, told it down to the smallest detail, down to the little moons and crescents that tinkled on the necks of his 10 dromedaries, and the precise value of the nose rings, arm bands, festal garments, and spices which had been the dowry of the maiden Rebekah, just as though it had been his own experience. He could not say enough about Rebekah's gentleness and charm on that evening when she had let down her pitcher upon her hand at the well by the city of Nahor and held it for the thirsty man to drink. Particularly, he treasured it in his memory that she had called him Lord. He told of the good breeding and propriety with which she had sprung from her camel and veiled herself at the first sight of Isaac, who had gone into the field to meditate upon the death of his mother. Joseph listened with a pleasure in no way marred by Eliezer's syntactical idiosyncrasies, and certainly not by the fact that the old man's ego was not quite clearly demarcated, that it opened at the back, as it were, and overflowed into spheres external to his own individuality, both in space and in time, embodying in his own experience events which, remembered and related in the clear light of day, ought actually to have been put into the third person. But then, just what do we mean by actually? And is man's ego a thing imprisoned in itself, and sternly shut up in its boundaries of flesh and time? Do not many of the elements which make it up belong to a world before it and outside of it? The notion that each person is himself and can be no other, is that anything more than a convention, which arbitrarily leaves out of account all the transitions which bind the individual consciousness to the general? The conception of individuality belongs, after all, to the same category of conceptions as that of unity and entirety, the whole and the all. And in the days of which I am writing, the distinction between spirit in general and individual spirit possessed not nearly so much power over the mind as in our world of today, which we have left behind us to tell of the other. It is highly significant that in those days there were no words for conceptions dealing with personality and individuality other than such external ones as confession, religion. Who Jacob was. It is entirely in this connection that I am led to tell the tale of the origin of Abram's riches. When he came into Lower Egypt, it must have been under the 12th dynasty, he was by no means so full of this world's goods as when he parted from Lot. His extraordinary increase came about in this wise. From the first, he had cherished the profoundest mistrust of the morals of the people. Rightly or wrongly, he considered them to be a marsh and a quagmire, like one of the mouths of the River Nile. He was fearful with respect to Sarah, his wife, who was with him and very beautiful to look upon. He was affrighted at the lust of the people, who would surely covet Sarah straightway, and kill him in order to take her to themselves. And the tradition has come down that when they came into the country, he commanded her in that sense, out of fear for his own safety, and told her to speak of herself as his sister, in order that the shameless people should not leer at her. This she might do without actually uttering falsehood, for it was the custom, especially in the land of Egypt, to use the word sister in referring to the beloved. And moreover, Sarai was a sister of Lot, whom Abram was used to regard as his nephew and brother, so that he might think of her as his niece, and give her the name of sister in the usual extended sense, which he accordingly did, for the purpose of misleading the stranger and protecting himself. What he expected came to pass, and more. Sarai's dusky loveliness was marked by high and low. News of it reached even to the throne of the ruler of the land, and the hot-eyed Oriental was taken from her brother's side, not by force or robbery, but for a high price. Purchased of him, that is, she being found worthy of admission to the choice society of Pharaoh's house of women. Thither she was conveyed, and her brother, whom one does not understand to have been in the least affronted by the arrangement, rather, in the common view, was considered a lucky fellow, was not only allowed to remain in her nearness, but was loaded down with favors, presents, and benefits from the court, which he calmly accepted, so that he was presently very rich in sheep, oxen, he-asses, men-servants, and maid-servants, she-asses, and camels. But meanwhile, though hidden from the ears of the common people, an extraordinary scandal had taken place at court. Amenemhet, or Senusret, it is not easy to be quite certain which conqueror of Nubia it was, who was just then bestowing upon both countries the blessing of his overlordship. His Majesty, then, a deity in the flower of his youth, was stricken with impotence, not once but repeatedly, when he was about to taste the novelty. It seems, moreover, that his entire court were stricken likewise, the highest dignitaries and administrators of the realm, with the same mortifying, and, when one takes into consideration the higher cosmic significance of the gift of virility, calamitous visitation. It was clear that something had gone wrong, that there was some mistake, possibly an evil spell, or the opposition of higher powers. The brother of the Jewess was brought before the throne, questioned, and pressed, and confessed the truth. The conduct of his sanctity was reasonable and dignified beyond all praise. "What is this," he asks, "that thou hast done unto me? Why hast thou exposed me to unpleasantness through thy double speaking?" And without a thought of depriving Abraham of any of the presents which he had so freely heaped upon him, he hands his wife over to him and tells them to go their ways in the name of the gods, giving the party safe conduct to the borders of the kingdom. Thus the father, not only in possession of an undefiled Sarah, but also so very much richer than before in worldly goods, might flatter himself that the simple shepherd had turned a very successful trick. One likes to think that he counted from the beginning on God being able in one way or another to prevent the defilement of Sarah, that he had pocketed all the gifts in this definite conviction, and felt certain that his method of going at the work would result in dealing the lustful Egyptian one in the eye. For only thus is his conduct, the denial of his marriage and the sacrifice of Sarah, set in the proper light, and seen for the masterly performance which it really was. This is the tale, for whose truth, tradition expressly vouches by repeating it a second time, when the scene is not Egypt but the land of the Philistines, and the capital city of Gerar, at the court of King Abimelech, whither the Chaldean had come from Hebron with Sarai, and where everything fell out precisely as before, from Abraham's command to his wife to the lucky outcome of the stratagem. This repetition of a narrative by way of emphasizing its truth is unusual without being very startling. It is far more remarkable that, according to tradition, the evidence for which, of course, in written form comes from a later time, but must have always existed as tradition, and thus goes back to the statements and utterances of the fathers themselves, the self-same experience, told for the third time, is ascribed to Isaac, from which it follows that he had committed it to memory as his experience, or the same as his. For Isaac, too, some time after the birth of his twins, on account of a dearth of corn, came into the land of the Philistines and the court at Gerar with his lovely and clever wife. He, too, on the same ground as Abraham, Sarai, gave out that Rebekah was his sister. Not quite falsely, since she was the daughter of his cousin Bethuel, and the story goes on to say that in this case King Abimelech looked out at a window, that is, as a secret spy and eavesdropper, and saw Isaac sporting with Rebekah his wife, and was as shocked and disillusioned as only a lover can be, when he learns that the object of his desires, whom he is supposed to be free, is in firm possession by another man. His words betray him, for Yitzchak, on being questioned, told the truth, whereupon the Philistine cried out reproachfully, "What is this that thou hast done unto us? For one of the people might lightly have lien with thy wife, and thou shouldst have brought guiltiness upon us." The phrase, "one of the people," is unmistakable, but the end of it was that the pair found themselves under the peculiar and personal protection of the God-fearing, if luxurious, king, and that under this protection Isaac increased in the land of the Philistines, just as Abraham had once done, either there or in Egypt, and grew so heavy with flocks and herds that it was finally too much even for the Philistines, and they discreetly got rid of him. Assuming that the scene of Abraham's adventure was Gerar, then it is not credible that the Abimelech of Yitzchak's adventure was the same as he who found himself prevented from defiling the purity of Sarah's married state. The characters are distinguished. Sarah's princely lover simply took her into his harem without more ado, whereas Isaac's Abimelech behaved with much more caution and reserve, so that we could only imagine them to be the same person, on the assumption that the king's more careful behavior in the case of Rebekah was due to his having grown much older since Sarah's day, also to his being already warned by what had happened the other time. But what interests us here is the personality not of Abimelech, but of Isaac, and the question of his relation to the story about the women. And even with this we are concerned only indirectly, and on account of the further question of who Jacob was. That Jacob, that is, whom we have heard talking with his little son Joseph, Yashub, or Jehoseph, in the moonlight. Let us weigh the possibilities. Either Yitzchak did himself in Gerar undergo, with slight variations, the same experience that had fallen his father, either there or in Egypt, and in this case we have a phenomenon which might be called imitation or succession, a conception, that is, which envisages the task of the individual person as the filling out in present time, and again making flesh certain given forms, a mythical frame that was established by the fathers, or else Rebekah's husband did not have the experience himself, not in the narrower fleshly limits of his ego, but regarded it, as it were, as belonging to his life history, and handed it down as such to his descendants, because he distinguished less sharply between the I and the not I than we, with how little justification has already been shown, are in the habit of doing, or were in the habit of doing until we embarked upon this narrative. For him, the life of the individual was more superficially separated from that of the tribe. Birth and death represented a less radical shock to existence. In short, he had the attitude of the latter Eliezer, to which we have already referred, when he related to Joseph in the first person stories about the original Eliezer, and displayed the phenomenon of the open identity, which accompanies that of imitation or succession, and alternately with it determines the consciousness of self. I do not conceal from myself the difficulty of writing about people who do not precisely know who they are. But also I make no question of the necessity of reckoning with these vacillating states of consciousness. And if the Isaac who relived Abraham's Egyptian adventure took himself for the Isaac whom the original wanderer would have offered up, the fact affords me no ground for the conviction that he did not deceive himself, and that the sacrifice temptation did not in fact belong to the scheme and recur repeatedly. The Chaldean wanderer was the father of the Isaac whom he would slay. But though it is impossible that this Isaac was the father of Joseph's father, whom we have seen by the well, yet it is quite conceivable that the Isaac, who either imitated Abraham's simple shepherd's game, or else wove it into his own personal life, confused himself, at least in part, with the Isaac who so narrowly escaped slaughter, although actually he was a much later Isaac, and generations removed from the original Abraham. Indeed, it is evident, so evident that a simple statement carries conviction without need of proof, that the history of Joseph's ancestors, as transmitted by tradition, is a pious abbreviation of the original facts, that is, of the succession of generations which must have filled up the centuries between the Jacob whom we have met and the original Abraham. Again, just as Abraham's house steward and natural son, Eliezer, must often have recurred in the flesh since the day when he wooed Rebekah for his young master, must often have wooed a Rebekah across the Euphrates, and now, in the person of Joseph's mentor, rejoiced once more in the light of day, just so, since then, had many an Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob beheld the birth of day out of night, without having any exaggeratedly precise ideas about time and the flesh, without making any very clear distinctions between their present and the present of aforetime, or delimiting their own individualities with references to the individualities of earlier Abrahams, Isaacs, and Jacobs. These names were handed on from generation to generation. If the word be accurate or comprehensive enough to apply to the community in which they recurred, for it was a community whose growth was not that of a family tree, but rather of a group of trees, resting as it did, moreover, in good part upon the propagation of the faith and the winning of souls. The tribal headship of the original Abraham must be understood as largely spiritual. Whether Joseph was actually related to him in the flesh, whether he was indeed his forefather, and in such a direct line as is assumed, is open to question. Open to question it was even for themselves, though the twilight of their own and the general consciousness permitted them to question it in a hazy and vaguely pious way, taking words for actuality, and actuality more than half for a word. They could call Abraham the Chaldean their grandfather and great-grandfather, more or less in the spirit in which he himself called Lot of Haran his brother and Sarah his sister, that too being both true and untrue at once. But not even in a dream could the people of El Elyon assert that their community possessed racial purity. Babylonian and Sumerian, that is, not entirely Semitic stock, had been crossed with seed from the desert of Arabia. From Gerar, Mizraland, Egypt itself, other elements had come in, for instance, in the person of the slave woman Hagar, who had been found not unworthy to share the bed of the head of the tribe, and whose son in turn had married an Egyptian. And it has always been too well known for me to waste more words upon it here, what vexation Rebekah suffered hourly from the Hittite wives of her Esau, daughters of a stock whose progenitor was not Shem, and which had come into Syria some time or other out of Asia Minor, and the Ural-Altai region. Many a branch dropped off by the way. We know that Abraham begot children after the death of Sarah, having taken to wife Keturah, a Canaanite woman. Not too nice a choice, considering his objection to the marriage of Isaac with a Canaanite. One of Keturah's sons was Midian, whose descendants dwelt south of Edom Seir, Esau's country, at the edge of the Arabian desert, like the children of Ishmael before Egypt. For Abraham gave all that he had unto Isaac, the true son, and put the children of the concubines off with gifts, and shoved them away eastwards, where they quite lost touch with El Elyon, if they had really ever had it, and worshipped their own gods. But godly was the bond of continual effort wreaked from generation to generation upon the idea of God. And in all the admixture of blood, it united the spiritual community, which, among the other Hebrews, the sons of Moab, Ammon, and Edom, particularly assumed this name unto itself, and precisely at the time to which we have arrived, began to associate it with another name, the name of Israel, which was destined to affect the common history. For the name and title which Jacob had wrested for himself had not been an invitation of his strange adversary. Israel, God fighteth, had always been the name of a warlike robber tribe of the desert, of highly primitive manners and customs. Small groups of these people had, at the time of the changing of pastures, driven their flocks among the settlements of the corn land, had exchanged their purely nomadic existence for a more or less settled state, and by conversion and agreement had become part of Abraham's communion of faith. Back in the wilderness, their god had been a fire-breathing and storm-breeding warrior named Yahu, a troublesome sort of hobgoblin, with more demonic than godlike traits, spiteful, tyrannical, and incalculable. His dusky people, though proud of his prowess, went in terror of their lives, ever seeking, by means of spells and blood rites, to harness their hare-brained divinity and lead him into ways profitable to themselves. Yahu might, without any clear provocation, fall by night upon a man whom he had every reason to treat with favor and kill him. But also he might be moved to abandon his purpose if the man's wife made haste to circumcise her son with a stone knife and touch the devil's genitals with the foreskin, at the same time incanting a mystic formula, the rendering of which into any kind of sensible English has so far encountered insurmountable difficulties, but which had power to soothe the demon and turn away his wrath. All this by way of giving an idea of what Yahu was like. For there was reserved for this sinister deity, entirely unknown to the civilized world, an extraordinary theological career. Merely by dint of the fact that some of his followers had penetrated into the sphere of influence occupied by Abraham's thoughts about God. Thus drawn into the orbit of the wanderer's spiritual speculations, these shepherd folk not only strengthened the physical basis of the Chaldeans' religious tradition, but also contributed elements of their own devastating deity to nourish the conception of the divine essence which was struggling towards realization through the spirit of mankind. To which, indeed, Osiris of the East, Tammuz, as well as Adonai, the mutilated son and shepherd of Melchizedek and his Shechemites, had also given color and substance. The very name, Yahu, once a war cry, we have just heard it chanted by certain lovely lips, in the form in which the god's dusky worshippers brought it out of the desert, as well as in abbreviations and variants which made it conform to the Canaanite dialect, was among the words used to make experiments in the inexpressible. For ages there had existed a village called Beteyah, the House of Yah, that is to say, Beth-El, or House of God. And there is evidence for the fact that before the days of the lawgiver, there were Amuru people who had immigrated into Shinar and brought their names with them, among them a name for God, which was Yahweh. Yes, the original Abraham had given to the tree by the shrine of Seven Springs the name of Yahweh El Olam, which is to say, Yahweh is the God of all the ages. But the name which Yahu's Bedouin warriors gave themselves was to become the name of Abraham's spiritual seed, and the distinctive badge of a purer and higher Hebraism, precisely because Jacob had had it whispered to him in that pregnant night by Jabbok Ford.